and the women from the neighboring houses left it at that. The first time they heard the bull-necked man shouting through the walls, they decided that each and every one must be allowed to mind their own business in their home. The second time they thought that all families fight sometimes, and maybe this was nothing more serious than that. When the bull-necked man was away the next time, Sonia invited in the woman and the boy for coffee. The woman explained with a strained laugh that the bruises were because she had thrown open a kitchen cabinet too quickly. In the evening, Rune met the bull-necked man in the parking area. He got out of his car in a clear state of intoxication. In the two nights that followed, the neighboring houses on either side overheard how the man was shouting in there and things were being thrown on the floor. They heard the woman giving a short cry of pain, and when the sound of the weeping 9-year-old boy pleading with the man to stop came through the wall, Uwe went outside and stood in front of his house. Rune was already waiting. They were in the midst of one of their worst ever power struggles in the steering group of the Residents Association, had not even spoken to each other for almost a year. Now they just briefly glanced at one another, and then went back into their houses without a word. 2 minutes later, they met fully dressed at the front. They rang the bell. The thug lashed out at them as soon as he opened the door, but Uwe's fist struck the bridge of his nose. The man lost his footing, got up, grabbed a kitchen knife, and ran at Uwe. He never got there. Rune's massive fist slugged him like a mallet. In his heyday, he was quite a piece, that Rune. Highly unwise to get involved in fisticuffs with him. The next day, the man left the house and never came back. The young woman slept with Anita and Rune for 2 weeks before she dared go home again with her boy. Then Rune and Uwe went into town and went to the bank, and in the evening, Sonia and Anita explained to the young woman that she could see it as a gift or a loan, whichever she preferred. But it wasn't open for discussion. And so it was that the young woman stayed on in the house with her son, a chubby, computer-loving little boy, whose name was Jimmy. Now, Uwe leans forward and looks with great seriousness at the gravestone.
I just thought I'd have more time somehow to do everything.
She doesn't answer.
I know how you feel about causing trouble, Sonia, but this time you have to understand. One can't reason with these people.
He pokes his thumbnail into the palm of his hand. The gravestone stays where it is without saying anything, but Uwe doesn't need words to know what she would have thought. The silent approach has always been her preferred trick when there are disputes with him, whether she's alive or dead. In the morning, Uwe had called that social services authority, or whatever the hell it was called. He'd called from Parvana's house because he no longer had a telephone line. Parvana had advised him to be friendly and approachable. It hadn't started so well because before long, Uwe had been connected to the responsible officer, which was the smoking man in the white shirt. He directly demonstrated a significant level of agitation about the little white Skoda, which was still parked at the end of the road outside Rune and Anita's house. And yes, Uwe could have established a better negotiating position if he'd immediately apologized about it, and maybe even agreed that it was regrettable that he'd intentionally put the man in the white shirt in this non-vehicular predicament. It would certainly have been better than the alternative, which was to hiss,
"So maybe you've learned to read signs now, illiterate bastard."
Uwe's next move involved trying to convince the man that Rune should not be put in a home. The man informed Uwe that illiterate bastard was a very bad choice of words for bringing up that subject. After this, there was a long series of impolite phrases on both ends of the telephone line, before Uwe declared in clear terms that things could not be allowed to work like this. One couldn't just come along and remove people from their homes and transport them to institutions any old way one liked, just because their memory was getting a bit defective. The man at the other end answered coldly that it didn't matter very much where they put Rune now, in the state he was in, because for him it would probably make a very marginal difference where he was. Uwe roared a series of invectives back. And then the man in the white shirt said something very stupid.
"The decision has been made. The investigation has been going on for 2 years. There's nothing you can do, Uwe, nothing at all."
And then he hung up. Uwe looked at Parvana, looked at Patrick, slammed Parvana's cell phone into their kitchen table, and boomed that they needed a new plan immediately. Parvana looked deeply unhappy, but Patrick nodded at once.
grabbed his crutches and hobbled quickly out the door, as if he'd just been waiting for Uwe to say that. 5 minutes later, to Uwe's deep dissatisfaction, he came back with that silly fop Anders from the neighboring house, with Jimmy cheerfully tagging along.
"What's he doing here?" said Uwe, pointing at the fop.
"I thought you needed a plan," said Patrick, nodding at the fop and looking very pleased with himself.
"Anders is our plan," Jimmy threw in.
Anders looked around the hall a little awkwardly, apparently slightly dissuaded by Uwe's expression. But Patrick and Jimmy insistently pushed him into the living room.
"Go on, tell him," Patrick prompted. "Tell me what?"
"Okay, so I heard you had some problems with the owner of that Skoda, yeah?" began Anders, giving Patrick a nervous glance. Uwe nodded impatiently for him to continue.
"Well, I don't think I've ever told you what sort of company I have I?
Anders went on, tentatively. Uwe put his hands in his pockets, adopted a slightly more relaxed position, and then Anders told him. And even Uwe had to admit that it sounded almost more than decently opportune.
"Where are you keeping that blonde bimbo?"
he started saying once Anders had finished. But he stopped himself when Parvana kicked his leg.
"Your girlfriend," he corrected himself.
"Oh, we split up. She moved out," said Anders, and looked at his shoes.
Whereupon he had to explain that apparently she'd become a bit upset about Uwe feuding so much with her and the dog. But her annoyance had been small beer compared to her agitation when Anders found out that Uwe called her dog Mutt and had not quite been able to stop himself smiling about it. And so it came to pass that when the chain-smoking man in the white shirt turned up on their road that afternoon accompanied by a police officer to demand that Uwe release the white Skoda from its captivity, both the trailer and the white Skoda were already gone. Uwe stood outside his house with his hands calmly tucked into his pockets, while his adversary finally lost his composure altogether and started roaring expletives at him. Uwe maintained that he had no idea how this had happened, but pointed out in a friendly manner that none of this would have happened in the first place if he just respected the sign that made it clear that cars were prohibited in the area. He obviously left out the detail that Anders owned a car towing company, and that one of his tow trucks had picked up the Skoda at lunchtime and then placed it in a large gravel pit 25 miles outside town. And when the police officer tactfully asked if he had really not seen anything, Uwe looked right into the eyes of the man in the white shirt and answered,
"I don't know, I may have forgotten. You start losing your memory at my age."
When the policeman looked around and then wondered why Uwe was standing about here in the street if he had nothing to do with the disappearance of the Skoda, Uwe just innocently shrugged his shoulders and peered at the man in the white shirt.
"There's still nothing good on TV."
Anger drained the man's face of color until, if possible, his face was even whiter than his shirt. He stormed off, raging that this was far from over. And of course it wasn't. Only an hour or so later, Anita opened the door to a courier, who gave her a certified letter from the council, signed, confirmed with the time and date of the transfer into care. And now, Uwe stands by Sonia's gravestone and manages to say something about how sorry he is.
"I get so damned worked up when I fight with people. I know that, but the reality of it is this. You'll just have to wait a bit longer for me up there. I don't have time to die right now."
Then he digs up the old frozen pink flowers out of the ground, plants the new ones, straightens up, folds up his deck chair, and walks toward the parking area while muttering something that sounds suspiciously like,
"Because there's a bloody war on."
Chapter 35. A Man Called Uwe, and Social Incompetence. When Parvana, with panic in her eyes, runs right into Uwe's hall and continues into the bathroom without even bothering to say good morning, Uwe immediately disputes how one can become so acutely in need of a pee in the space of the 20 seconds it takes her to walk from her own house to his. "But hell has no fury like a pregnant woman in need," Sonia once informed him, so he keeps his mouth shut. The neighbors are saying he's been like a different person these last days, that they've never seen him so engaged before. But as Uwe irritably explains to them, that's only because Uwe has never bloody engaged himself in their particular business before. He's always been a bloody engaged person. Patrick says the way he walks between the houses and slams the doors the whole time is like a really angry avenging robot from the future. Uwe doesn't know what he means by that,
But anyway, he spent hours at a time in the evenings sitting with Parvana and Patrick and the girls, while Patrick, to the best of his abilities, has tried to get Uva not to put angry fingerprints all over Patrick's computer monitor whenever he wants to show them something. Jimmy, Mursad, Adrian, and Anders have also been there. Jimmy has repeatedly tried to get everyone to call Parvana and Patrick's kitchen the Death Star and Uva Darth Uva. They've considered countless plans over the last few days, including planting marijuana in the white-shirted man's shed, as Rune might have suggested. But after a few nights, Uva seems to give up. He nods grimly, demands to use the telephone, and shuffles off into the next room to make a call. He didn't like doing it, but when there's a war on, there's a war. Parvana comes out of the bathroom.
Are you done?
Uva wonders, as if he's suspecting this to be some sort of halftime interval. She nods. But just as they're on their way out the door, she notices something in his living room and stops. Uva is standing in the doorway, but he knows very well what she's staring at. It's...
Ah! What the hell, it's nothing special, he mumbles and tries to wave her out the door.
When she fails to move, he gives the edge of the doorframe a hard kick.
It was only gathering dust. I sanded it down and repainted it and applied another layer of lacquer, that's all. It's no big bloody deal, he grumbles, irritated.
Oh, Uva, whispers Parvana.
Uva occupies himself checking the threshold with a couple of kicks.
We can sand it down and repaint it pink, if it's a girl, I mean, he mutters.
Clears his throat.
Or if it's a boy, boys can have pink nowadays, can't they?
Parvana looks at the light blue crib, her hand across her mouth.
If you start crying now, you're not having it, warns Uva.
And when she starts crying anyway, Uva sighs.
Bloody women.
And turns around and starts walking down the road. The man in the white shirt extinguishes his cigarette under his shoe and bangs on Anita and Rune's door about half an hour later. He's brought along three young men in nurse uniforms as if he's expecting violent resistance. When frail little Anita opens the door, the three young men look a touch ashamed of themselves, more than anything. But the man in the white shirt takes a step towards her and waves his document in the air as if holding an axe in his hands.
It's time, he informs her with a certain impatience and tries to step into the hall.
But she places herself in his way.
As much as a person of her size can place herself in anyone's way.
No, she says without budging an inch. The man in the white shirt stops and looks at her, shakes his head tiredly at her and tightens the skin around his nose until it almost seems to be swallowed up in his cheek flesh.
You've had 2 years to do this the easy way, Anita, and now the decision has been made, and that's all there is to it.
He tries to get past her again, but Anita stays where she is, on her threshold, immovable, as an ancient standing stone. She takes a deep breath without breaking their eye contact.
What sort of love is it if you hand someone over when it gets difficult? She cries, her voice shaking with sorrow. Abandon someone when there's resistance? Tell me what sort of love that is.
The man pinches his lips. There's a nervous twitch around his cheekbones.
Rune doesn't even know where he is half the time. The investigation has showed that...
But I know, Anita interrupts and points at the three nurses. I know, she cries at them.
And who's going to take care of him, Anita?
He asks rhetorically, shaking his head. Then he takes a step forward and gestures for the three nurses to follow him into the house.
I'm going to take care of him, answers Anita, her gaze as dark as a burial at sea.
The man in the white shirt just continues shaking his head as he pushes past her. And only then does he see the shadow rising up behind her.
And so will I, says Uva.
And I will, says Parvana.
And me,
say Patrick, Jimmy, Anders, Adrian, and Mursad with a single voice as they push their way into the doorway until they're falling over each other. The man in the white shirt stops, his eyes narrow into slits. Suddenly, a woman wearing beat-up jeans and a slightly too big green windbreaker turns up at his side with a voice recorder in her hand.
I'm from the local newspaper, Lena announces, and I'd like to ask you a few questions.
The man in the white shirt looks at her for a long time, then he turns his gaze on Uva. The two men stare at one another in silence. Lena, the journalist, produces a pile of papers from her bag. She presses this into the man's arms.
These are all the patients you and your section have been in charge of in recent years. All the people like Rune, who have been taken into care and put in homes against their own and their family's wishes. All the irregularities that have taken place at geriatric residential care where you have been in charge of the placements. All the points where rules have not been followed and correct procedures have not been observed, she states. She does so in a tone as if she were handing over the keys of a car he'd just won in the lottery. Then she adds with a smile. The great thing about scrutinizing bureaucracy when you're a journalist, you see, is that the first people to break the laws of bureaucracy are always the bureaucrats themselves. The man in the white shirt does not spare a single look at her. He keeps staring at Uwe. Not a word comes from either of them. Slowly, the man in the white shirt clamps his jaws together. Patrick clears his throat behind Uwe and jumps out of the house on his crutches, nodding at the pile of papers in the man's arms. We've also got your bank statements from the last 7 years, and all the train and air tickets you've bought with your card and all the hotels you've stayed in, and all the web history from your work computer and all your email correspondence, both work and personal. The eyes of the man in the white shirt wander from one to the other. His jaw is so tightly clamped together that the skin on his face is turning pale. Not that there would be anything you want to keep secret, says Lena with a smirk. Not at all, Patrick agrees. But you know, once you start really digging into someone's past, you usually find something they'd rather keep to themselves, says Lena. Something they'd rather forget, Patrick clarifies with a nod towards the living room where Rune's head sticks out of one of the armchairs. The TV is on in there. A smell of fresh brewed coffee comes through the door. Patrick points one of his crutches, giving a little poke at the pile of paper in the man's arms, so that a sprinkling of snow settles over the man's white shirt. I'd especially take a look at that internet history if I were you, he explains. And then they all stand there, Anita and Parvana and that journalist woman, and Patrick and Uwe and Jimmy and Anders and Adrian and Mirsad, and the man in the white shirt, and the three nurses, in the sort of silence that only exists in the seconds before all the players in a poker game who have bet everything they've got put their cards on the table. Finally, after an interval that, for all involved, feels like being held underwater with no possibility of breathing, the man in the white shirt starts slowly leafing through the papers in his arms. Where did you get all this shit? He hisses, his shoulders hoisted up around his neck. On the internet, rages Uwe, abrupt and furious as he steps out of Anita and Rune's row house with his fists clenched by his hips. The man in the white shirt looks up again. Lena clears her throat and pokes helpfully at the pile of paper. Maybe there's nothing illegal in all these old records, but my editor's pretty certain that with the right kind of media scrutiny, it would take months for your section to go through all the legal processes, years, maybe. Gently, she puts her hand on the man's shoulder. So I think it might be easiest for everyone concerned if you just leave now, she whispers. And then, to Uva's sincere surprise, the little man does just that. He turns around and leaves, followed by the three nurses. He goes around the corner and disappears the way shadows do when the sun reaches its apex in the sky, or like villains at the ends of stories. Lena nods, self-satisfied, at Uwe. I told you no one has the stomach for a fight with journalists. Uwe shoves his hands into his pockets. Don't forget what you promised me, she grins. Uwe groans. Did you read the letter I sent you, by the way? She asks. He shakes his head. Do it, she insists. Uwe answers with something that might either be a yeah, yeah, or a fierce exhalation of air through the nostrils. Difficult to judge. When Uwe leaves the house an hour later, he's been sitting in the living room, talking quietly, and one-to-one with Rune for a long time because he and Rune needed to talk without disruption. Uwe explained irritably before he drove Parvana, Anita, and Patrick into the kitchen. And if Anita hadn't known better, she could have sworn that in the minutes that followed, she heard Rune laughing out loud several times. Chapter 36 A Man Called Uwe and a Whiskey. It is difficult to admit that one is wrong, particularly when one has been wrong for a very long time. Sonia used to say that Uwe had only admitted he was wrong on one occasion in all the years they had been married, and that was in the early 1980s after he'd agreed with her about something that later turned out to be incorrect. Uwe himself maintained that this was a lie, a damned lie. By definition, he had only admitted that she was wrong, not that he was.
Loving someone is like moving into a house, Sonia used to say. At first you fall in love with all the new things, amazed every morning that all this belongs to you, as if fearing that someone would suddenly come rushing in through the door to explain that a terrible mistake had been made. You weren't actually supposed to live in a wonderful place like this. Then, over the years, the walls become weathered, the wood splinters here and there, and you start to love that house not so much because of all its perfection, but rather for its imperfections. You get to know all the nooks and crannies, how to avoid getting the key caught in the lock when it's cold outside, which of the floorboards flex slightly when one steps on them, or exactly how to open the wardrobe doors without them creaking. These are the little secrets that make it your home.
Uwe, of course, suspected that he represented the wardrobe door in the example, and from time to time he heard Sonia muttering that, "Sometimes I wonder if there's anything to be done, when the whole foundations are wonky from the very start," when she was angry with him. He knew very well what she was driving at.
"I'm just saying surely it depends on the cost of the diesel engine and what its consumption is per mile," says Parvana, unconcernedly, slowing the sob down at a red light and trying with some grunts to settle herself more comfortably in her seat.
Uwe looks at her with boundless disappointment, as if she really hasn't listened to anything he's said. He's made an effort to educate this pregnant woman in the fundamentals of owning a car. He's explained that one has to change one's car every 3 years to avoid losing money. He has painstakingly run through what all people who know anything are well aware of, namely that one has to drive at least 12,000 miles per year to save any money by opting for a diesel rather than a gas engine. And what does she do? She starts blabbering, disagreeing as usual, debating things like, "Surely you don't save money by buying a car new, and it must depend on how much the car costs." And then she says, "Why?"
"Because," says Uwe.
"Right," says Parvana, rolling her eyes in a way that makes Uwe suspect she is not accepting his authority on the topic as one might reasonably expect her to. A few minutes later, she's stopped in the parking area on the other side of the street. "I'll wait here," she says.
"Don't touch my radio settings," orders Uwe.
"As if I would," she brays, with a sort of smile that Uwe has begun to dislike in the last few weeks. "It was nice that you came over yesterday," she adds.
Uwe replies with one of his sounds that isn't words as such, more a sort of clearing of his air passages. She pats him on the knee.
"The girls are happy when you come over. They like you."
Uwe gets out of the car without answering. There wasn't much wrong with the meal last night, he can stretch to admitting that. Although Uwe doesn't feel there's a need to make such a palaver about cooking as Parvana does. Meat and potatoes and gravy are perfectly adequate. But if one has to complicate things like she does, Uwe could possibly agree that her rice with saffron is reasonably edible. It is, so he had two portions of it, and the cat had one and a half. After dinner, while Patrick washed up, the three-year-old had demanded that Uwe read her a bedtime story. Uwe found it very difficult to reason with the little troll because she didn't seem to understand normal argumentation, so he followed her with dissatisfaction through the front hall towards her room and sat on her bedside, reading to her with his usual Uwe excitement, as Parvana once described it, although Uwe didn't know what the hell she meant by that. When the three-year-old fell asleep with her head partly on his arm and partly on the open book, Uwe had put both her and the cat in the bed and turned out the light. On the way back along the hall, he'd gone past the seven-year-old's room. She was sitting in front of her computer, of course, tapping away. This seemed to be all kids did these days, as Uwe understood it. Patrick had explained that he'd tried to give her newer games, but she only wanted to play that one, which made Uwe more favorably disposed both to the seven-year-old and to her computer game. Uwe liked people who didn't do what Patrick told them to do. There were drawings everywhere on the walls in her room, black and white pencil sketches mostly. Not at all bad, considering that they had been created by the absence of deductive faculties and highly undeveloped motor function of a seven-year-old, Uwe was willing to admit. None of them were of people, only houses. Uwe found this extremely engaging. He stepped into the room and stood beside her, She looked up from the computer with the dour expression this kid always seemed to lug about with her, and in fact, she didn't seem too pleased about his presence. But when Uwe stayed where he was, she pointed at last to an upside-down storage crate made of plastic on the floor. Uwe sat down on it, and she started quietly explaining to him that the game was about building houses and then making cities out of the houses.
"I like houses," she muttered quietly.
Uwe looked at her. She looked at him. Uwe put his index finger on the screen, leaving a large fingerprint, pointing at an empty space at the town and asking her what happened if she clicked that spot. She moved her cursor there and clicked, and in a flash the computer had put up a house there. Uwe looked fairly suspicious about it. Then he made himself comfortable on the plastic box and pointed at another empty space. 2.5 hours later, Parvana stomped in angrily and threatened to pull out the plug if they didn't call it a night at once. As Uwe stood in the doorway getting ready to leave, the 7-year-old carefully tugged at his shirt sleeve and pointed at a drawing on the wall right next to him.
"That's your house," she whispered,
as if it was a secret between her and Uwe. Uwe nodded. Maybe they weren't totally worthless after all, those two kids. He leaves Parvana in the parking area, crosses the street, opens the glass door, and steps in. The cafe is empty. The fan heater overhead coughs as if it's full of cigar smoke. Amel stands behind a counter in a stained shirt, wiping glasses with a white towel. His stocky body has sunk into itself, as if at the end of a very long breath. His face bears that combination of deep sorrow and inconsolable anger which only men of his generation and from his part of the world seem capable of mastering. Uwe stays where he is, in the center of the floor. The two men watch one another for a minute or so. One of them a man who can't bring himself to kick out a homosexual youth from his house, and the other who couldn't stop himself. Eventually, Uwe nods grimly and sits down on one of the bar stools. He folds his hands together on the counter and gives Amel a dried look.
"I wouldn't be adverse to that whiskey now if it's still on offer."
Amel's chest rises and falls in a couple of jerky breaths under the stained shirt. At first, he seems to be considering opening his mouth, but then he thinks again. In silence, he finishes wiping his glasses, folds up the towel and puts it next to the espresso machine. Disappears into the kitchen without a word. Comes back with 2 glasses and a bottle. The letters on the label illegible to Uwe. Puts these down on the counter between them. It is difficult to admit that one is wrong, particularly when one has been wrong for a very long time. Chapter 37. A man called Uwe and a lot of bastards sticking their noses in.
"I'm sorry about this," Uwe creaks.
He brushes the snow off the gravestone.
"But you know how it is. People have no respect at all for personal boundaries anymore. They charge into your house without knocking and cause a commotion. You can hardly even sit on the crapper in peace anymore," he explains, while he digs the frozen flowers out of the ground
and presses down the new ones through the snow. He looks at her as if he's expecting her to nod her agreement. But she doesn't, of course. The cat sits next to Uwe in the snow and looks like it absolutely agrees, especially with that bit about not being allowed to go to the toilet in peace. Lena had come by Uwe's house in the morning to drop off a copy of the newspaper. He was on the front page, looking like the archetypal grumpy old sod. He kept his word and let her interview him, but he wasn't smiling like a donkey for the camera. He told him that in no uncertain terms. "It's a fantastic interview," she insisted proudly. Uwe didn't respond. But this did not seem to concern her. She looked impatient and sort of paced on the spot while glancing at her watch as if in a hurry.
"Don't let me hold you up," muttered Uwe.
She managed a teenager's repressed titter by way of an answer. "Me and Anders are going skating on the lake." Uwe merely nodded at this point, taking this as confirmation that the conversation was over, and closed the door. He put the newspaper under the doormat. It would come in handy for absorbing the snow and slush brought in by the cat and Mersad. Back in the kitchen, he began clearing up all the advertising and free newspapers that Adrian had left with the day's mail. Sonia might have managed to teach the rascal to read Shakespeare, but apparently he could not understand a 3-word sign that said, "No junk mail," At the bottom of the pile, he found the letter from Lena, the one Adrian had delivered that first time he rang Uva's doorbell. Back then, the youth rang the doorbell, at least. Nowadays, he ran in and out of the door as if he lived here, Uva grumbled, as he held the letter up to the kitchen lamp like a banknote being checked. Then he got out a table knife from the kitchen drawer. Even though Sonya got mad every time he used a table knife to open an envelope rather than fetching the letter opener. Dear Uva, I hope you'll excuse me contacting you like this. Lena at the newspaper has let me know that you don't want to make a big thing out of this, but she was kind enough to give me your address. Because for me it was a big thing, and I don't want to be the sort of person who does not say that to you, Uva. I respect that you don't want to let me thank you personally, but at least I want to introduce you to some people who will always be grateful to you for your courage and selflessness. People like you are not made anymore. Thanks is too small a word. It was signed by the man in the gray suit and black overcoat, the one Uva hoisted off the track after he passed out. Lena had told Uva that the swooning fit had been caused by some sort of complicated brain disease. If they hadn't discovered it and started treating it when they did, it would have claimed his life within a few years. So, in a way, you saved his life twice over, she'd exclaimed in that excitable tone of voice that made Uva regret a little not having left her locked up inside the garage while he still had the chance. He folded up the letter and put it back in the envelope. Held up the photo. Three children, the oldest a teenager, and the others more or less the same age as Parvana's oldest daughter, looked back at him. Or rather, they weren't really looking, they were sort of lying about in a pile, each with a water pistol, and apparently laughing until they were practically screaming. Behind them stood a blonde woman of about 45 with a wide grin and her arms stretched out like a large bird of prey and an overflowing plastic bucket in each hand. At the bottom of the pile lay the man in the gray suit but wearing a blue polo shirt and trying in vain to shield himself from the downpour. Uva threw away the letter along with the advertising, tied up the bag, put it by the front door, went back into the kitchen, got out a magnet from the bottom drawer and put up the photo on the fridge, right next to the riotous color drawing the three-year-old had made of him on the way back from the hospital. Uva brushes his hand over the gravestone again, even though he's already brushed off all the snow that can be brushed off. Well, yes, I told them one might like a bit of peace and quiet like a normal human being, but they don't listen. They don't, he moans, waving his arms tiredly towards the gravestone. Hi, Sonya, says Parvana behind him, with a cheerful wave, so that her big mittens slip off her hands.
Hodge,
the three-year-old hollers happily.
Hi, you're supposed to say hi,
the seven-year-old corrects.
Hi, Sonya,
say Patrick, Jimmy, Adrian, and Mursad, all nodding, in turn. Uva stamps the snow off his shoes and nods with a grunt at the cat beside him.
Yeah, and the cat you already know.
Parvana's belly is now so big that she looks like a giant tortoise when she heaves herself down into a squatting position, one hand on the gravestone and the other hooked around Patrick's arm. Not that Uva dares bring up the giant tortoise metaphor, of course. There are more pleasant ways of killing oneself, he feels, and that's speaking as someone who's already tried quite a few of them.
This flower is from Patrick and the children and me, says Parvana, with a friendly smile at the stone.
Then she holds up another flower and adds, and this one's from Anita and Rune. They send loads of love. The multifarious gathering turns around to go back to the parking area, but Parvana stays by the gravestone. When Uva wants to know why, she just says,
never you bloody mind,
to him with the sort of smile that makes Uva want to throw things at her. Nothing hard, perhaps, but something symbolic. He replies with a snort in the lower octave range, then finds, after a certain amount of inner deliberation, that a discussion with both of those women at the same time would be redundant from the very start. He starts going back to the sob.
Girl talk,
says Parvana succinctly, when at last she comes back to the parking area and gets into the driver's seat. Uva doesn't know what she means by that, but he decides to leave it alone. Nazanin's big sister helps her with her belt in the back seat. In the meantime, Jimmy, Mursad, and Patrick have managed to squeeze into Adrian's new car in front of them. A Toyota. Hardly an optimal choice of car for any kind of thinking person, Uva had pointed out to him many times while they stood there at the dealership.
But at least it wasn't French. And Uwe managed to get the price reduced by almost 8,000 kroner and made sure that the kid got winter tires thrown in for the same price. So it seemed acceptable in spite of it all. When Uwe got to the dealership, the bloody kid had been checking out a Hyundai, so it could have been worse. Once they make it back to their street, they go their separate ways. Uwe, Mursad, and the cat wave at Parvana, Patrick, Jimmy, and the children and turn off around the corner by Uva's tool shed. It's difficult to judge how long the stocky man has been waiting outside Uva's house, maybe all morning. He has the determined look of a straight-backed sentry posted somewhere in the field, in the wilderness, as if he's been cut from a thick tree trunk and the below-freezing temperature is of no concern to him. But when Mursad comes walking around the corner and the stocky man catches sight of him, he quickly comes to life. "Hello," he says, stretching, shifting his body weight back to the first foot.
"Hello, Dad," mumbles Mursad.
That evening, Uwe has his dinner with Parvana and Patrick while a father and son talk about disappointments and hopes and masculinity in two languages in Uwe's kitchen. Maybe most of all, they speak of courage. Sonia would have liked it, Uwe knows that much, but he tries not to smile so much that Parvana notices. Before the 7-year-old goes to bed, she presses a paper into Uwe's hand, on which is written, "Birthday Party Invitation." Uwe reads through it as if it were a legal transfer of rights for a leasehold agreement.
"I see. And then you'll be wanting presents, I expect," he huffs at last.
She looks down at the floor and shakes her head.
"You don't have to buy anything. I only want one thing, anyway."
Uwe folds up the invitation and puts it in the back pocket of his trousers. Then, with a degree of authority, presses the palms of his hands against his sides.
"Right?
Mom says it's too expensive anyway, so it doesn't matter,"
she says without looking up and then shakes her head again. Uwe nods conspiratorially like a criminal who has just made a sign to another criminal that the telephone they are using is wiretapped. He and the girl look around the hall to check that neither her mother nor her father have their nosy ears around some corner surreptitiously listening to them. And then Uwe leans forward and the girl forms her hands in a funnel round her face and whispers into his ear.
"An iPad."
Uwe looks a little as if she had just said,
"An advertisement." "It's a sort of computer. There are special drawing programs for it for children," she whispers a little louder.
And something is shining in her eyes. Something that Uwe recognizes. Chapter 38. A Man Called Uwe and the End of a Story. Broadly speaking, there are two kinds of people. Those who understand how extremely useful white cables can be, and those who don't. Jimmy is the first of these. He loves white cables, and white telephones, and white computer monitors with fruit on the back. That's more or less the sum of what Uwe has absorbed during the car journey into town, when Jimmy natters on excitedly about the sorts of things every rational person ought to be so insuperably interested in, until Uwe, at last, sinks into a sort of deeply meditative state of mind, in which the overweight young man's babbling turns into a dull hissing in his ears. As soon as the young man thundered into the passenger seat of the Saab with a large sandwich in his hand, Uwe obviously wished he hadn't asked for Jimmy's help with this. Things are not improved by Jimmy aimlessly shuffling off to check a few leads as soon as they enter the shop.
"If you want something done, you have to do it yourself, as usual," Uwe confirms to himself as he steers his steps alone towards the sales assistant.
And not until Uwe roars,
"Have you been frontally lobotomized, or what?"
to the young man who's trying to show him the shop's range of portable computers does Jimmy come hurrying to his aid. And then it's not Uwe, but rather the shop assistant, who needs to be aided. "We're together," Jimmy nods to the assistant with a glance that sort of functions as a secret handshake to communicate the message. "Don't worry, I'm one of you." The sales assistant takes a long, frustrated breath and points at Uwe.
"I'm trying to help him, but..." "You're just trying to fob me over with a load of crap, that's what you're doing,"
Uwe yells back at him without letting him get to a full stop, and menacing him with something he spontaneously snatches off the nearest shelf. Uwe doesn't quite know what it is, but it looks like a white electrical plug of some sort.
and it feels like the sort of thing he could throw very hard at the sales assistant, if the need arises. The sales assistant looks at Jimmy with a sort of twitching around his eyes, that Uwe seems adept at generating of people with whom he comes into contact. This is so frequent that one could possibly name a syndrome after him. "He didn't mean any harm, man," Jimmy tries to say pleasantly. "I'm trying to show him a MacBook, and he's asking me what sort of car I drive," the sales assistant bursts out, looking genuinely hurt.
"It's a relevant question," mutters Uwe with a firm nod at Jimmy.
"I don't have a car because I think it's unnecessary, and I want to use more environmentally friendly modes of transportation," says the sales assistant, in a tone of voice pitched somewhere between intransigent anger and the fetal position. Uwe looks at Jimmy and throws out his arms, as if this should explain everything.
"You can't reason with a person like that."
He nods and evidently expects immediate support.
"Where the hell have you been, anyway?"
"I was just checking out the monitors over there, you know," explains Jimmy.
"Are you buying a monitor?" asks Uwe.
"No," says Jimmy, and looks at Uwe as if it was a really strange question, more or less in the way that Sonia used to ask, "What's that got to do with it?" when Uwe asked her if she really needed another pair of shoes. The sales assistant tries to turn around and steal away, but Uwe quickly puts his leg forward to stop him.
"Where are you going? We're not done here."
The sales assistant looks deeply unhappy now. Jimmy pats him on the back to encourage him. "Uwe here just wants to check out an iPad. Can you sort us out?" The sales assistant gives Uwe a grim look. "Okay, but as I was trying to ask him earlier, what model do you want, the 16, 32, or 64 gigabyte? Uwe looks at the sales assistant as if he feels the latter should stop regurgitating random combinations of letters. "There are different versions with different amounts of memory," Jimmy translates for Uwe, as if he were an interpreter for the Department of Immigration.
"And I suppose they want a hell of a lot of extra money for it," Uwe snorts back.
Jimmy nods his understanding of the situation and turns to the sales assistant. "I think Uwe wants to know a little more about the differences between the various models." The sales assistant groans.
"Well, do you want the normal or the 3G model, then?"
Jimmy turns to Uwe.
"Will it be used mainly at home, or will she use it outdoors as well?"
Uwe pokes his flashlight finger into the air and points it dead straight at the sales assistant.
"Hey, I want her to have the best one. Understood?"
The sales assistant takes a nervous step back. Jimmy grins and opens his massive arms as if preparing himself for a big hug.
"Let's say 3G, 128 gig, all the bells and whistles you've got. And can you throw in a cable?"
A few minutes later, Uwe snatches the plastic bag with the iPad box from the counter, mumbling something about 18,295 kroner and they didn't even throw in a keyboard, followed by thieves, bandits, and various obscenities. And so it turns out that the 7-year-old gets an iPad that evening from Uwe, and a lead from Jimmy. She stands in the hall just inside the door, not quite sure what to do with that information, and in the end she just nods and says, "Really nice, thanks." Jimmy nods expansively.
"You got any snacks?"
She points to the living room, which is full of people. In the middle of the room is a birthday cake with 8 lit candles, towards which the well-built young man immediately navigates. The girl, who is now an 8-year-old, stays in the hall, touching the iPad box with amazement, as if she hardly dares believe that she's actually got it in her hands. Uwe leans toward her.
"That's how I always felt every time I bought a new car," he says in a low voice.
She looks around to make sure no one else can see. Then she smiles and gives him a hug.
"Thanks, Granddad,"
she whispers and runs into her room. Uwe stands quietly in the hall, poking his house keys against the calluses on one of his palms. Patrick comes limping along on his crutches in pursuit of the 8-year-old. Apparently he's been given the evening's most thankless task, that of convincing his daughter that it's more fun sitting there in a dress, eating cake with a lot of boring grown-ups, than staying in a room listening to pop music and downloading apps onto her new iPad. Uwe stays in the hall with his jacket on and stares emptily at the floor for what must be almost 10 minutes.
"Are you okay?"
Pavana's voice tugs gently at him, as if he is coming out of a deep dream. She's standing in the opening to the living room with her hands on her globular stomach, balancing it in front of her as if it were a large laundry basket.
Yuva looks up, slightly hazy in his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, of course I am.
You want to come in and have some cake?
No, I don't like cake. I'll just take a little walk with the cat.
Pravana's big brown eyes hold on to him in that piercing way as they do more and more often these days, which always makes him very unsettled, as if she's filled with dark premonitions.
Okay,
she says at last, without any real conviction in her voice. I'll be having a driving lesson tomorrow. I'll ring your doorbell at 8, she suggests after that. Uwe nods. The cat strolls into the hall with cake in its whiskers.
Are you done now?
Uwe snorts at it, and when the cat looks ready to confirm that it is, Uwe glances at Pravana, fidgets a little with his keys, and agrees in a low voice.
Right. Tomorrow morning at 8, then.
The dense winter darkness has descended when Uwe and the cat venture out into the little walkway between the houses. The laughter and music of the birthday party well out like a big warm carpet between the walls.
Sonya would have liked it, Uwe thinks to himself.
She would have loved what was happening to the place with the arrival of this crazy pregnant foreign woman and her utterly ungovernable family. She would have laughed a lot. And God, how much Uwe misses that laugh. He walks up towards the parking area with the cat, checks all the signposts by giving them a good kick, tugs at the garage doors, makes a detour over the guest parking, and then comes back, checks the trash room. As they come back between the houses alongside Uva's tool shed, Uwe sees something moving down by the last house on Parvana and Patrick's side of the road. At first, Uwe thinks it's one of the party guests, but soon he sees that the figure is moving by the shed belonging to the dark house of that recycling family. They, as far as Uwe knows, are still in Thailand. He squints into the gloom to be sure that the shadows are not deceiving him, and for a few seconds he actually doesn't see anything. But then, just as he's ready to admit that his eyesight is not what it used to be, the figure reappears, and behind him another two. And then he hears the unmistakable sound of someone tapping with a hammer at a window that's covered in insulation tape. Which is how one minimizes the noise when the glass shatters. Uwe knows exactly what it sounds like. He learned how to do it on the railways when they had to knock out broken train windows without cutting their fingers.
Hey, what are you doing? He calls through the darkness.
The figures down by the house stop moving. Uwe hears voices.
Hey, you!
He bellows, and starts running towards them. He sees one of them take a couple of steps toward him, and he hears one of them shouting something. Uwe increases his pace and charges at them like a human battering ram. He has time to think that he should have brought something from the tool shed to fight with, but now it's too late. From the corner of his eye, he notices one of the figures swinging something long and narrow in one fist, so Uwe decides he has to hit that bastard first. When there's a stabbing feeling in his breast, he thinks at first that one of them has managed to attack him from behind and thump a fist into his back. But then there's another stab, from inside. Worse than ever, as if someone were skewering him from the scalp down, methodically working a sword all the way through his body until it comes out through the soles of his feet. Uwe gasps for air, but there's no air to be had. He falls in the middle of a stride, tumbles with his full weight into the snow. Perceives the dulled pain of his cheeks scraping against the ice, and feels how something seems to be squeezing the insides of his chest in a big merciless fist, like an aluminum can being crushed in the hand. Uwe hears the running steps of the burglars in the snow and realizes that they are fleeing. He doesn't know how many seconds pass, but the pain in his head, like a long line of fluorescent tubes exploding, is unbearable. He wants to cry out, but there's no oxygen in his lungs. All he hears is Parvana's remote voice through the deafening sound of pulsating blood in his ears. Perceives the tottering steps when she stumbles and slips through the snow, her disproportionate body on those tiny feet. The last thing Uwe has time to think before everything goes dark is that he has to make her promise that she won't let the ambulance drive down between the houses, because vehicular traffic is prohibited in the residential area. Chapter 39 A Man Called Uwe. Death is a strange thing. People live their whole lives as if it does not exist, and yet it's often one of the great motivations for living. Some of us, in time, become so conscious of it that we live harder, more obstinately, with more fury. Some need its constant presence to even be aware of its antithesis. Others become so preoccupied with it that they go into the waiting room long before it has announced its arrival. We fear it, yet most of us fear more than anything that it may take someone other than ourselves. For the greatest fear of death is always that it will pass us by and leave us there alone. People had always said that Uwe was bitter, but he wasn't bloody bitter. He just didn't go around grinning the whole time. Did that mean one had to be treated like a criminal? Uwe hardly thought so. Something inside a man goes to pieces when he has to bury the only person who ever understood him. There is no time to heal that sort of wound. And time is a curious thing. Most of us only live for the time that lies right ahead of us, a few days, weeks, years. One of the most painful moments in a person's life probably comes with the insight that an age has been reached when there is more to look back on than ahead, and when time no longer lies ahead of one, other things have to be lived for. Memories, perhaps. Afternoons in the sun with someone's hand clutched in one's own. The fragrance of flower beds in fresh bloom. Sundays in a cafe. Grandchildren, perhaps. One finds a way of living for the sake of someone else's future. And it wasn't as if Uwe also died when Sonya left him. He just stopped living. Grief is a strange thing. When the hospital staff refused to let Parvana accompany Uva's stretcher into the operating room, it took the combined efforts of Patrick, Jimmy, Anders, Adrian, Mirsad, and four nurses to hold her back and her flying fists. When a doctor told her to consider the fact that she was pregnant and cautioned her to sit down and take it easy, Parvana overturned one of the wooden benches in the waiting room so that it landed on his foot. And when another doctor came out of a door with a clinically neutral expression and a curt way of expressing himself about preparing yourselves for the worst, she screamed out loud and collapsed on the floor like a shattered porcelain vase, her face buried in her hands. Love is a strange thing. It takes you by surprise. It's 3:30 in the morning when a nurse comes to get her. She has refused to leave the waiting room. Her hair is one big mess, her eyes bloodshot and caked with streams of dried tears and mascara. When she steps into the little room at the end of the corridor, she looks so weak at first that a nurse rushes forward to stop the pregnant woman crumbling to pieces as she crosses the threshold. Ravana supports herself against the doorframe, takes a deep breath, smiles an infinitely faint smile at the nurse, and assures her that she's okay. She takes a step into the room and remains there for a second, as if for the first time that night she can take in the full enormity of what has happened. Then she goes up to the bed and stands next to it with fresh tears in her eyes. With both palms, she starts thumping Uva's arm. "You're not dying on me, Uwe," she weeps. "Don't even think about it." Uwe's fingers move weakly. She grabs them with both hands and puts her forehead in the palm of his hand.
"I think you'd better calm yourself down, woman," Uwe whispers hoarsely.
And then she hits him on the arm again, and then he sees the wisdom of keeping quiet for a while. But she stays there with his hand in hers and slumps into the chair with that mix of agitation, empathy, and sheer terror in those big brown eyes of hers. At this point, he lifts his other hand and strokes her hair. He has tubes going up his nose, and his chest moves strenuously under the covers. As if his every breath is one long impulse of pain, his words come out, wheezing.
"You didn't let those sods bring the ambulance into the residential area, did you?"
It takes about 40 minutes before any of the nurses finally have the guts to go back into the room. A few moments later, a bespectacled young doctor wearing plastic slippers, who, in Uva's view, has the distinct appearance of someone with a stick up his ass, comes into the room and stands dozily by the bed. He looks down at a paper.
"Parnava?"
He broods and gives Parvana a distracted look.
"Parvane,"
she corrects. The doctor doesn't look particularly concerned.
"You're listed here as the next of kin,"
he says, glancing briefly at this emphatically Iranian 30-year-old woman on the chair and this emphatically un-Iranian Swede in the bed. When neither of them makes the slightest effort to explain how this can be, other than Parvana giving Uwe a little shove and sniggering, "Ah, next of kin," and Uwe responding, "Shut it, will you?" The doctor sighs and continues,
Uva has a heart problem, he begins in an anodyne voice, following this up with a series of terms that no human being with less than 10 years of medical training or an entirely unhealthy addiction to certain television series could ever be expected to understand. When Parvana gives him a look studded with a long line of question marks and exclamation marks, the doctor sighs again, in that way young doctors with glasses and plastic slippers and a stick up their ass often do when confronted by people who do not even have the common bloody decency to attend medical school before they come to the hospital. His heart is too big, the doctor states crassly. Parvana stares blankly at him for a very long time, and then she looks at Uva in the bed in a very searching way. And then she looks at the doctor again as if she's waiting for him to throw out his arms and start making jazzy movements with his fingers and crying out, "Only joking!" And when he doesn't do this, she starts to laugh. First, it's more like a cough, then as if she's holding back a sneeze, and before long, it's a long, sustained, raucous bout of giggling. She holds on to the side of the bed, waves her hand in front of her face as if to fan herself into stopping, but it doesn't help. And then at last, it turns into one loud, long-drawn belly laugh that bursts out of the room and makes the nurses in the corridor stick their heads through the door and ask and wonder, what's going on in here?
You see what I have to put up with?
Uva hisses wearily at the doctor, rolling his eyes while Parvana, overwhelmed with hysterics, buries her face in one of the pillows. The doctor looks as if there was never a seminar on how to deal with this type of situation, so in the end he clears his throat loudly and sort of brings his foot down with a quick stamping motion, in order to remind them of his authority, so to speak. It doesn't do much good, of course, but after many more attempts, Parvana gets herself into order enough to manage to say, Uva's heart is too big. I think I'm going to die.
It's me who's bloody dying,
Uva objects. Parvana shakes her head and smiles warmly at the doctor.
Was that all?
The doctor closes his file with resignation.
If he takes his medication, we can keep it under control, but it's difficult to be sure about things like this. He could have a few more months or a few years.
Parvana gives him a dismissive wave.
Oh, don't concern yourself about that. Uva is quite clearly utterly lousy at dying.
Uva looks quite offended by that. 4 days later, Uva limps through the snow to his house. He's supported on one side by Parvana and on the other by Patrick. One is on crutches and the other knocked up. That's the support you get, he thinks. But he doesn't say it. Parvana just had a tantrum when Uva wouldn't let her back the sob down between the houses a few minutes ago.
I know, Uva. Okay, I know. If you say it one more time, I swear to God, I'll set fire to your bloody sign,
she shouted at him, which Uva felt was a little overly dramatic, to say the least. The snow creaks under his shoes. The windows are lit up. The cat sits outside the door waiting. There are drawings spread across the table in the kitchen.
The girls drew them for you, says Parvana,
and puts his spare keys in the basket next to the telephone. When she sees Uva's eyes reading the letters in the bottom corner of one of the drawings, she looks slightly embarrassed.
Sorry, Uva, don't worry about what they've written. You know how children are. My father died in Iran. They've never had a... you know.
Uva takes no notice of her, just takes the drawings in his hand and goes to the kitchen drawers.
They can call me whatever they like. No need for you to stick your bloody nose in.
And then he puts up the drawings one by one on the fridge. The one that says, to Granddad, gets the top spot. She tries not to smile. Doesn't succeed very convincingly.
Stop sniggering and put the coffee on instead. I'm fetching down the cardboard boxes from the attic,
Uva mumbles and limps off towards the stairs. So, that evening, Parvana and the girls help him clean up his house. They wrap each and every one of Sonia's things in newspaper and carefully pack all her clothes into boxes, one memory at a time. And at 9:30, when everything is done and the girls have fallen asleep on Uva's sofa with newsprint on their fingertips and chocolate ice cream around the corners of their mouths, then Parvana's hand suddenly grips Uva's upper arm like a voracious metal claw. And when Uva growls,
"Ouch!"
she growls back,
"Shush!"
And then they have to go back to the hospital.
It's a boy.
A Man Called Uva and an Epilogue. Life is a curious thing. Winter turns to spring,
and Parvana passes her driving test. Uva teaches Adrian how to change tires. The kid may have bought a Toyota, but that doesn't mean he's entirely beyond help, Uva explains to Sonia when he visits her one Sunday in April. Then he shows her some photographs of Parvana's little boy. 4 months old and as fat as a seal pup. Patrick has tried to force one of the